Hello, and welcome to the Epic Echo Media Musings. In this podcast, we'll look at the movies and TV shows you know and love, and the things in them that we don't love so much. We'll shed our insight on the problematic pieces of the media we consume while giving you tips to use those pieces to start great conversations. The point of our podcast isn't that you stop watching your favorite shows and movies, but instead to help you use them to start empowering conversations with the folks you watch them with. Enjoy. Hello, Epic Echo listeners. Today's episode contains language that could be difficult or triggering for some listeners to hear pertaining to violence. If you need help or support, please call our helpline at 304-263-8292. Today we're going to be talking about 50 Shades of Grey. 50 Shades of Grey was released on February 13th, 2015 into theaters. The movie follows college senior Anastasia Steele, played by Dakota Johnson, a senior in college who meets prominent businessman Christian Grey, Jamie Dornan, while interviewing in their campus paper. The connection between Anna and Christian is the focus of the movie. 50 Shades of Grey was directed by Sam Taylor Johnson and based on the book series by E.L. James. The genre of the book and film series is labeled as erotic romance, and the film is rated R for strong sexual content, including dialogue, some unusual behavior and graphic nudity, and for language. Within the first week of its release, the movie sold over $300 million in tickets, and despite negative reviews, it would go on to break records and eventually gross over $570 million worldwide. In the case of the 50 Shades books, however, we must also examine the impact of those that preceded the films. 50 Shades of Grey has topped bestseller lists around the world, including those of the United Kingdom and the United States. The series had sold over 125 million copies worldwide by June 2015, while by October 2017, it had sold more than 150 million copies worldwide. The series has been translated into 52 languages and set a record in the United Kingdom as the fastest selling paperback of all time. Those things are all basically just the facts. This is what we were presented with when we decided to talk about 50 Shades of Grey. The content of the movie, though, is going to be a little bit more of the conversation that we're going to have. On today's episode, I have Executive Director of the Eastern Panhandle Empowerment Center, Katie Spriggs, and she's going to offer her opinion, her expert opinion, if you will, on basically her take when she watched the movie for herself. So, Katie, if you would just give me your one-off first initial reaction to the first time you saw this film.
Yeah, sure. Thanks for having me, Nora. I'm excited. My first time on an Epic podcast. My initial reaction, so I actually read the books before I watched the film. And I read the books because I read a lot and they were top of the bestsellers, right? Like everyone was reading them at the time. And I read the first book and I think all three of them were out already at the time and was horrified. But then like still read the next two because I had to know where the story was going. And it didn't get any better. And then I actually only watched the film because my grandma, my 82-year-old grandma, is obsessed with this series, which is, we have a lot to unpack there. But and I actually only watched the film because I had to take her to the movie theater, but I saw it at premiere. So I went to literally like the day after the premiere. I think we were there on Valentine's Day. And I have since seen all three movies many times because she watches them so much. And my first reaction, of course, like wearing my advocate hat, was how they glorified this extremely dangerous and toxic relationship and how they glorified, how they really played in to the false narrative in our nation, in our world, that says that if you're an abuse victim yourself, you will then abuse others. Because they really leaned hard, as particularly in the books, on Christian's childhood sex abuse experience and neglect in his childhood and his childhood trauma. Nora, I don't know if you saw it. I don't remember actually if this is featured in any of the movies, but in the books, it explains that Christian accidentally committed homicide against his brother. So he killed his brother when he was a child on accident with a firearm that was left in the home. So they really dig into like this trauma that he experienced in his lifetime and how that justifies the way that he treats Anastasia, or the way that he acts in general in the books and in the movies. And I was terrified because I was like, this is a top selling book. It's going to become a movie. Then it like sold out movie theaters worldwide. And I was like, this is the representation of a relationship that we now have millions and billions of people looking up to. And that was the, and I've had so many discussions with my grandma, who, born in 1939, she thinks that this is like a love story. And that's what she says. She's like, I don't watch it, you know, for anything other than the love story. And I'm like, it's not a love story, right? So I think if you were to ask my one-off opinion, it's that it's a very dangerous portrayal of a relationship that they call healthy, but it's an extremely volatile relationship that should not be portrayed as healthy.
I definitely could not agree with you more. The impact of the film is specifically why in the intro, I wanted to include all those numbers about like what number it was on the bestseller list, how many copies it sold, how many people bought tickets to this movie, because I wanted the audience to understand the reach that this film and book series has already had. Like, that's millions and millions of viewings and readings of this same material. And that means that lots of people now know the story. And the whole point of this podcast, Media Musings, is to teach them how we can still view all of this really popular media, but through a lens that's going to make it easier for us to learn that these behaviors are not actually healthy. There were a few things that stood out to me, a couple of which that I'm hoping to talk with you about, Katie, because I know that I want to get your opinion as well. One of the bigger overarching themes, obviously, being the relationship depicted in the films and the books, is a relationship in which BDSM is present in their sexual relations, which is, you know, neither here nor there. That's not the point of this podcast. The point is that the representation of BDSM is inaccurate, and a lot of folks may not have any exposure to know that. BDSM is supposed to be consensual. It can be done safely. It can be done consensually, and it can be done within the context of a healthy relationship. But this example that we get in 50 Shades is not that. Would you agree?
Oh, for sure. And I think it's dangerous, again, to the BDSM community, that they portrayed the reason that Christian was interested in BDSM in the books is portrayed and in the movies because of his child sexual abuse. They also portrayed that woman, the perpetrator of Christian's child sexual abuse, as like the older woman that's like interested in the younger guy. And it's like sort of fantasy world. And I'm like, this is abuse. This is a horrible abuse that clearly affected him, right? Later in his life, like, we can see the effects of his child sex abuse in the way that he makes relationships in the future. And yeah, so I think it's dangerous because it's portrayed as if someone only becomes interested in BDSM if they have this horrible, sordid childhood trauma. And that's just not real. They also portray it as if it's just okay that Anastasia repeatedly does not consent to these things. And that when she does consent, she consents under coercion or even pressure from him, kind of saying like, well, it's either this way or no way. Like, if you want to be with me, this is it, which is a tactic used frequently in domestic violence relationships, and a tactic used frequently in sexual assault, specifically of the most vulnerable generations, the 18 to 24 year olds, which is who Anastasia is portraying. So it's so dangerous in across all the ways. But yeah, I agree that one of the kind of like biggest offenders in this series is how they portray the BDSM relationship that existing within their relationship, and that they do not really talk about healthy consent ever in the whole series.
I'm so glad you brought up consent, because that exactly just shoots us right into where I wanted to go next. The contract. This is something that now, after watching the movie in preparation for this episode, I kind of understand. I was reading, you know, the synopsis and all that before, and I didn't understand this contract. The contract in the depiction that this story gives us is meant to erase a need for consent in any further sexual contact between these two people. While contracts are present in relationships such as marriage and prenups and so on and so forth, there's contracts that are fully binding in relationships. there's no contract legally binding that allows you to not need consent to have sex with someone. That's not real. I think that's a really, really dangerous inaccuracy that this movie portrays. And I think that that's something that I would really like to clear up.
Oh, for sure. And it's also sending a direct message to survivors that, like, your consent, you can just, it's almost just saying that, like, your consent doesn't even matter. Like, if this contract says you consented to it, then you consented to it, like, whatever. And the whole contract going back and forth, like, in the movie, where it's like humorous, like, it's almost like they depict it to be a cute little, like, anecdotal conversation between these two where they go back and forth, and like it'll pan to her like in the movies, and she's like smiling and laughing when she's reading this contract, and she's like, I don't think so. And it's almost like it's a joke, but you're literally talking about felony sexual assault, like, that is being committed and making her sign off on essentially saying, I won't charge you with it, which, again, you're right, you can't do that in real life. But also, just like, it's terrifyingly glossed over. I think that's the biggest problem I have with it, is it's just like treated like it's this little like anecdotal cute thing they do. But like in reality, it would almost be like signing a paper that said, like, if my husband murdered me, it's fine. Like, it's a felony, like, it's a felony. Like, it's a big deal. And I think that was alarming to me for sure when I watched it.
Right. I think of this whole contract situation almost as if someone came into your house one day and you fed them dinner, and then they put a contract in front of you that said, okay, now every time I show up to your house, you're required to feed me dinner. That contract is meaningless. It's just a piece of paper with a signature on it. And yet we have just sold millions and millions of books and tickets to see this movie that is giving the impression to these college-aged individuals that if you give consent once, you give consent forever. And that's not the way consent works. You need consent each time you enter into sexual relations, and consent can be revoked as well, as it was several times depicted between these two characters, that Anna was trying to revoke her consent, and that just was never tolerated.
She did like attempt to revoke her consent, he would be angry.
Right.
That's also not healthy or normal. And it was portrayed like he's the victim. Like, oh, she's saying all of a sudden doesn't want to do this thing she already agreed to. And that's so dangerous, because the people who are investigating these cases and prosecuting and being the judge on these cases are seeing this in the media. So they're like, oh, well, you shouldn't have reversed your consent. Like, that's how it relates to real life, which is really the part about it that's the most.
You brought up a little bit earlier, we were talking about domestic abuse, dating abuse, and I really want to sit with that for a moment, because, I mean, the definition of dating abuse is that it's about power and control. Those are the two main factors in an abusive relationship, and those are pretty much the only examples of this relationship that we get. We get Christian exercising power and control over Anna over and over and over again, but again, it's depicted to us in this like healthy, new, budding relationship. But it's literally depicting all of these signs of dating abuse. And so I think that that's important to talk about. And I'm going to bring up one specific example from a dinner scene with Christian's family, where Anna reveals that she was going to go and visit her family or her mother, perhaps. And Christian gets angry and says that she never told him that, and punishes her. So we have an adult in a relationship being punished by another adult in a relationship. And I can't really think of a more clear way to show that power and control is not equally distributed in this relationship, and therefore it's unhealthy. So I didn't know if you'd maybe want to add anything to that.
Oh, yeah. And then if memory serves, he shows up at the mother's house. Is that the second book or I'm confusing the books, but yeah, he shows up like when she's on this trip visiting her mom across the country. It's not like she's like next town over, flies out specifically to like arrive, and it's all treated as if it's cute. Like, oh, he showed up, like he buys the business she works for just so that he can be her boss. He buys the apartment complex she lives in so that he can have access to the building. I don't know if you remember the scene where they're like walking on the street and she almost like walks out in front of a car, and he's like sort of grabs her and prevents her from getting hit by the car, but then like yells at her. He's like, you're so dumb. You know, it's like, wow. Like, she can't even exist on a street. It's super toxic. And it would be a great example of a terrible relationship if they portrayed it that way, but they portray it like it's goals. It's like, oh, like my creepy man loves me so much that he flies across the country to be with me when I'm visiting my mom, who I haven't seen in a year, when I didn't ask him to and also told him not to come. He buys her the cell phone so that he can monitor it. It's just all, like you said, repeated examples of power and control that are glossed over as if they're like cute or attractive.
Well, even from the beginning, I mean, when I was reading just the initial blurb that it's probably written on the back of the movie cases, when you hear just how they met, I mean, the power was already unequal in the beginning of that relationship. She was the student, she was coming to him looking for an opportunity. There's already a power difference there, and you can't start a healthy relationship from a situation like that. So from the very beginning, we get several examples of an abuse of power and control in this relationship, but like you're saying, not only in this first book that we're kind of spending a lot of time talking about, but throughout the entire series, it's not only shown, but it's almost expected by the audience, as well as, you know, the non-fiction or the fictional characters that are also in the series, that Anna does these things because she loves him. And then also there's this sense of like, she's trying to fix him somehow through doing all of these things. And I think that that's another really, really dangerous rhetoric to be putting out into this target audience of, you know, young individuals, because I mean, that's not a healthy way to start a relationship, by thinking that you're capable of fixing someone who has issues that you are not equipped to deal with. And I think that that's something that a lot of maybe young adults could relate to. So do you have anything you'd like to add as far as that goes?
Oh yeah, it's really dangerous, because there's already this like societal phenomenon that we're taught from a very young age that as women growing up in the society, that it's our duty and our job to like help our partner, particularly if they're a cisgendered man, through all of their problems, and like, you're the only thing that can fix them, and they just need a woman to get them straight. And like those kinds of things that we've been hearing, you know, indoctrinated to us since we were children. And then to have it portrayed as adult, like we're adults now, and we're seeing this as adults, and they're adults. She's just sort of thinking that she can make him better. And they're justifying all of his behavior by this fact that he's a victim himself. And like, well, I mean, she's the only thing that could save him from himself. Like that kind of portray, like she's the only one who truly loves him. And it's like, well, he needs like clinical intervention that she cannot provide. And it's unhealthy if she is trying to provide it, especially in the way that they portray. It's not like she's helping him heal. She's more just like obeying him because that's what makes him happy. And like, I know there were times in the books where she would sort of, you know, resist. I remember one instance was with the friend. She had like that friend that was a boy, and he, you know, Christian was like, you're not allowed to be around him anymore or whatever. And she was like, well, I'm going to do it anyway. And come to find out, this boy like had a crush on her, whatever. And Christian was like, see, I was right. And they portrayed him as being like rightly jealous, like, oh, he's appropriately jealous because he was right in the end. But it's like, no, he was completely out of line in the way that he handled that situation. He was completely controlling of her behavior and who she hangs out with. And all of these things are unacceptable, but it was portrayed as if it was like romantic and he was right in the end. So it doesn't matter that, you know, he acted the way that he acted throughout.
Yeah, another really interesting point that you just kind of drew for me is that during all of this, while she's trying to, you know, fix him, and eventually, unfortunately, the story does show that somehow the two of them are able to leave all of this behind, so on and so forth. But the important takeaway here is that she is seen by the audience, whether you're recognizing it or not, as taking responsibility for his, you know, his trauma, his issues, but he's never really seen taking responsibility for those. She's, you know, letting him do all of these things to make him feel better, and she's going the extra mile to make him happy, but we never really see him take any responsibility for, you know, taking hold of his own trauma, trying to get himself any help. So I think that that's also a really dangerous narrative, in that it does kind of portray women as the ones that need to take the responsibility to fix these issues in relationships, when, as we all know, that should not be the way that is.
No, and even like at one point he's still talking to that older woman who abused him, and you know, Anna's trying to make him stop, which is probably the only healthy like dynamic demonstrated in the whole shebang. But and it almost like as the series, you know, progresses, they almost like shove Anna in as the replacement to his abuser. So it's like, well, I got to get rid of my abuser, but she supports me, and she, you know, we talk about everything. She's my confidant, which is common in you know, child sexual trauma, that the children who were abused will still have ongoing relationships with their abuser. Like, that's common. But what is not healthy is the portrayal of, okay, we get rid of her and we shove Anna in, and Anna's now the, you know, light of his life and the only thing that matters. Like, that's an unhealthy transition in and of itself too.
You're absolutely right. That's putting a lot of weight and pressure on other survivors who are watching this film that, well, I mean, if it was that easy for this individual to replace his abuser with someone who is giving him something positive out of life, it must be that easy for everyone, when in reality, it's not that easy. And it's also not the fix. That's not going to fix your issues. It's great to have a support system, and that's surely a way to start. But that's not going to be a fix for your problems. A relationship is not going to take away your trauma, unfortunately.
Right. And it's a lot to put on one person. It was a lot to put on Anna, which you can see the, you know, effects it has on her. Is she so, and you can kind of see it at times in the film, like when he shows up at work and she's like in a work meeting with a guy. This is the last film, I think, because she like has a really big office and she's like, you know, running the show. And she's in a work meeting with this male, and Christian like barges in and is like, I own this building and you're my wife, because they were married by that point. And she was kind of just like, oh my God. Like, you can kind of see, she was like exasperated. So you can see, like, if you watch how she's portrayed, it does change her as a person and changes the way that she reacts to situations. And that's also very dangerous, because it's like, oh, you know, you're going through a lot, just lay it all on this other human being, and that's fine. And then they have to accept everything you give them as if it's normal. And that's pretty terrifying too.
Yeah, all around, I think we've pretty much covered the ways that this relationship is super toxic, although it's presented to us as a healthy and romantic relationship. We would obviously argue that it is, on the flip side, actually abusive. There's a few other issues with. There's a character in the film, his name is Jose. He ends up being a bit of a sexual predator. And the important thing to note about this film and about this character is that not only is this character seen as a threatening male presence that she needs to be, you know, kind of saved from, it is also the only non-white character in the entire film, and he is presented to us as a predator. So I was wondering if you maybe wanted to touch on that for a little bit.
Oh yeah, that's terrifying. And it's so sadly so common in mainstream media films where the only individuals of color in the movie are either like the drug dealer or the perpetrator in some way. And Jose is introduced to us as like her friend, and like it goes south really fast, which is another like weird dynamic that they created. Like they've been friends for how long, we don't know. But all of a sudden was like a predator because Christian said he was. It was just a weird like dynamic in the way that they introduced that character. And yeah, and of course, that was the only person of color in the whole film. The other part of this film that sort of gets me on the anti-oppression kind of field is, if this was all occurring with a very low income person, family, this would be labeled domestic violence, right? Like, this film wouldn't have reached, because this person wouldn't have been able to buy their business. Like, this, it would be a completely different world if we were talking about A, individuals of color, or even someone in LGBTQ relationship being portrayed this way, or somebody from a lower income bracket. Like, it would be a completely different conversation on a national level. So there's so many ways we could dig into that, but there's definitely some very like, almost like hidden, dangerous biases presented in this film. It's the more you think about it, the more you think of.
You're absolutely right, and I can definitely tell that you've been in this field for a while, because you absolutely predicted where I was going next. I was definitely going to talk about that wealth disparity. I I mean, we've all seen TV shows, we've all seen films that depict domestic violence or abusive relationships in impoverished folks. They're ugly. They show the physical abuse in ways that are ugly and dirty and harsh and just, it's hard to watch.
And often inaccurate.
And often inaccurate, exactly. And then we see on the flip this film that is glamorous. It is just, they are the vision of a nice, wealthy, white American couple, except for the things that happen behind closed doors and the fact that their relationship is, you know, dark and twisted. But even those scenes, the scenes that were supposed to be perceived as, you know, a little bit dark, even for Anna, the other character in the movie, are still perceived as glorious and everything is just pristine and white and beautiful, but it's portraying abuse. So it is a very, very stark contrast to what we normally get.
Oh yeah. And like, think about, I mean, we're obviously in the domestic violence field and I know neither of us work directly with clients anymore, but we certainly live in the atmosphere of it. And I can't even count in the last year, the number of survivors that we've worked with at Epic where their abuser has shown up at their place of work. And Christian didn't have to show up with a shotgun at, you know, McDonald's where Anna worked because he could just buy the business and then he could show up anytime he wants. So it's still stalking. It's just like very wealthy version of stalking, buying his way in instead of, you know, being super aggressive up front. But it's the same dynamic that they're creating and then painting it with this like illusion of this being really sweet. But if you put it in a different context, like let's imagine Anna worked at McDonald's and Christian rolls up, you know, angry that she dared went to work when he says she doesn't need to work. And he walks in and says that, like, can you imagine how that would be taken by witnesses in McDonald's compared to us watching this movie and witnessing what's happening?
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. We're going to go move into our final segment, which is going to be to talk about the ways we can use this movie to start conversations that are going to be effective in preventing this type of violence in the future. Some things that I just really feel are important to note about this film before we move on from talking about the content are that, again, BDSM can be done safely and consensually within the context of a healthy relationship. This depiction in this film, however, is not that. I also want to touch on, because sometimes these things tend to go hand in hand, strangulation can also be consensual. However, there is no way to physically control the effects of strangulation on an individual, and therefore it is never fully safe to restrict someone's airway, even consensually. If you practice consensual strangulation during sex, you should still check in with medical providers regularly in order to identify any possible health concerns that could stem from strangulation. I just wanted to preface with that, just in case. If you've seen the movie, obviously you know what we're talking about. If not, then you should just take all of those things to heart with you anyway. All right, now for the question that we are all here today to ask. I would like, in your words, Katie, before I give mine, I would like you to tell me the ways in which you hope this movie is going to be used now after people listen to this podcast, because they will. I hope that you can tell them how they can use these movies that still might be one of their favorites to start conversations that can be productive and that will kind of rip away the veil of this being a healthy relationship.
Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah, I think we have to start, and I do this, by the way, all the time. Like I said, my grandma is a fan of 50 Shades of Grey. She's technically a fan of Jamie Dornan, the actor, and watches every single thing he's in ever, and has posters of him and t-shirts of him, and like, it's a whole thing. But her love for him started with this series, so this is her kind of fallback. And so we have these conversations all of the time. And what I've done that's been very effective with her is I've validated what she thinks she's getting out of it. So I've said, like, Grandma, I understand that you want to see a love story and you think that this is one. And you love the fact that he has this sort of character arch where he starts out as the sullen loner, no friends, barely speaks to anyone except this abuser. And then, you know, has all this childhood trauma that he hasn't unpacked. And then you see him kind of grow over the series to become a family, you know, a dad and a husband, and they throw a really cute wedding. And like, so I tried to validate that, like, I understand what you think you're seeing in it, but we can't possibly talk about that and not talk about the danger that this series presents. And I've tried to give her, you know, real life examples. So I have said, like, how would you feel if a behavior that he showed, if you saw someone do that to me, like my dating partner, the thing that Christian did to Anna, how would you feel if that happened to someone that you're related to, someone that you love? And she was like, well, I mean, that's not okay. Like that sort of starts. So I'm hoping that if you do love this series or know someone that loves this series, you could start by having them think a little deeper about the like unintended consequences. I mean, you could argue that it was intended by some parties involved, but the unintended consequences of the horribly unhealthy relationship and the horrible representation of BDSM and the horrible representation of consent, and how you can interweave those conversations into ones that are even talking in support of the movie to just sort of highlight some of the ways that this could be dangerous, while still not just being like, oh, your favorite movie is trash, right? Because then you just lost them. But I would love to also hear your ideas, Nora.
Yeah, they were going to be a lot of the same stuff. I do think that for me, because I think maybe that I'm a part of this younger demographic that is represented in the movie, I'm 22, not too far off from where Anna was during it. I think that if I were talking to my peers, some of which I know have seen this movie and who enjoy the movies and the books, I know lots and lots of people that I went to college with that read them and loved them. And I think that the conversation that I would choose to open up with those people is about sexual boundaries, just because of the age demographic that we're in. Obviously, I would echo all of those things that you said, but in the air of not being too redundant, I'm going to choose this as the one that I kind of want to harp on. And I would definitely use this film as examples on negative examples of crossing sexual boundaries, because there's just so many examples that we could choose from. I mean, we could start at the consent contract and just kind of keep on going, and our list would trail on as long as the CVS receipt, I truly believe. I also would tell my peers that we should take movies that portray wealthy relationships with a grain of salt, because this, again, more often than not, they kind of get away with a little bit more than impoverished couples on TV and movies do. Everything that anyone under the poverty line seems to do in a lot of media is definitely depicted in a more grotesque way, and that includes relationships, but there are plenty of examples of power and control abuses in wealthy couples in media, and I just ask that when you see a wealthy couple, you kind of try to take the wealth out of it when it comes to media, and you just see it for what it is at face value, and in this case, that is a horribly unhealthy relationship with just so many examples of cross-sexual boundaries. And I think that that's where I would take the conversation. But I would like to add that the whole point of this podcast is not to ruin your favorite movies, contrary to popular belief after what you might have heard already today. We're not trying to ruin your favorite movies. We're not trying to tell you that you can't watch your favorite movies. We're trying to teach you the tools that you need to have with you in order to learn from the experiences that happen in these movies.
Oh yeah. And like this could start so many good conversations. You could start a conversation around masculinity and how Christian was raised to suppress the trauma that he experienced in his lifetime, and how like a lot of the things that we're watching on screen would have been mitigated earlier in his life if he had gotten the proper treatment and felt like he could talk about these things that have happened to him. If he grew up in a society where that was acceptable, if, you know, his family was accepting of that. And so, yeah, I think there's so many ways it could go, but it for sure doesn't have to ruin the enjoyment that you get out of watching this story. But I think that's the other thing I would encourage people to see, is that this is a story. This is a made up story. 50 Shades of Grey is based off of fan fiction that was written about Twilight. So it's like based off of two made up stories. And I think it doesn't represent real life relationships at all. And that I think would be the hill, like you said, the thing you'd be willing to harp on. I think that's what I would, like the hill I would die on, is like, you can love it as a story, but you have to see it as a story. And you also have to see all of the toxic things that it might be influencing other peers, and be willing to have those conversations openly, and be willing to continue to have those conversations, because there will be more 50 Shades of Grey, right? So just sort of, how do we keep that conversation going as loudly as we can?
Absolutely. And with these series, we hope to continue to bring you the tools to start those conversations. They're really important conversations that just aren't being had enough, in our opinion. So we really hope that you'll take all of the things that we've talked about today, and at your next viewing party for 50 Shades of Grey, that you will start one of these conversations. Katie mentioned that 50 Shades of Grey is Twilight fan fiction. That is absolutely true. And I believe this episode will air before the next, so I can go ahead and say it. Our next guest and our next media musing is actually going to be on Twilight. So not only are we getting the fan fiction, but we will also be talking about the source of the fan fiction material and that relationship in a completely other episode. So Katie, thank you so much for being with me today. I'm so glad we were able to talk about this, and I had a great time.
Thank you. I had a great time too. And I just have to say that Twilight was one of my favorite book series ever. Didn't enjoy the movies as much. So like, that's when we make the point that we're not trying to discourage you from liking your own stuff. I was a Twilight head. I loved it. I went to the premiere, midnight premiere. So like, I get it. And I have had to cope with my own pieces of that, you know, fairy tale that are terribly depicted and dangerous, while still loving it as what it gave me in my childhood. So yeah, I'm excited. I'm excited to listen to that one. And I was excited to be invited here today. So thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Media Musings. Do you have an idea for a TV show or a movie that we should talk about next? Send your ideas over to us at epicwv.org/epic-echo. Thanks for listening.